Okay, a very good evening to everybody. Thank you for coming out on this delightfully cool, breezy night. In recognition of your efforts of coming tonight, we are going to go places that no one has ever gone before.
Kitchen?
Almost. More exciting than that. It's called Not Bar Not. And if you didn't ever hear the terminology, you would undoubtedly look at the top line of our handout and say that we were going to visit Nat. I don't know if it's Nat the cat, but it's certainly some early preschool reader of some sort. And it's not. Not Bar Not is one of the more advanced concepts in Kashrus. We tend to refer to it simply as something cooked in fleishik kalim, or something cooked in milchik kalim. And we mean by that, very, very simply, that we took a parav item, rice, potatoes, you name it, parav item, and we cooked it in a pot that we call meat, or we call dairy. Take a case of macaroni. You cooked macaroni in a milchik pot, thinking that you were going to turn it into macaroni and cheese. But after you cooked it in the milchik pot, some of it sat in the pot, was never used with the cheese, and you decide that you'd like to use that macaroni with a fleishik meal. Are you allowed to do it?
No.
Is that your final answer?
Yes.
Okay. Now, where does this term come from? Take a look at the second line. I give it to you there. It's an acronym, an abbreviation. It comes from nosein tam, something that's giving taste, bar nosein tam, the son of something that gave taste. In other words, we're not dealing with original taste. It's not that you cooked the spaghetti macaroni with the cheese or with the meatballs. You cooked it in a pot. What's fleishik about it? What's milchik about it? Well, it once had fleishik in it. That fleishik emitted its taste into the walls of the pot. Then the fleishik was removed. The pot was thoroughly scrubbed out. And then we put water into the pot. Macaroni, spaghetti, something parav into the pot now, so that the fleishik that went into the walls is now coming out. But in Hebrew terminology, it's ta'am kalush. It's weakened taste. In other words, we readily acknowledge that there can be taste in the walls of a pot. And we stand by that with confidence. That's our tradition. And not that we need proof, but recent allergy studies prove that that's indeed true. In fact, we say that it's batel b'shishim. Once it's nullified in 60, we're comfortable ignoring it because it no longer will be tasted. And in allergies, they're worried a lot further than 60. That's, by the way, we'll see in a few moments, one of the reasons that some of the kashrus agencies are uncomfortable certifying something dairy equipment is because of people who have dairy allergies. Mm-hmm. And if they're going to start doing anything other than a dairy designation, some of the kashrus agencies are worried they're going to get sued. by someone with a severe allergy who has it and then finds that it wasn't as pure non-dairy as they thought. That argument deserves commentary, but it does illuminate a little bit what we're talking about. There's definitely taste, but in a case of nat bar nat, a taste of a taste, there's no fleishik that can be found. If you look for it, you won't find it. There's no milchik to be found. But it was a fleishik pat. And therefore, we're paying attention. We need to know the ramifications. It was a milchik pat. I need to know what ramifications it has. Yeah?
Doesn't the material of the pot...
Can't hear you.
The material of the pot.
Irrelevant.
A ceramic pot, a glass pot, aluminum, stainless steel, copper...
For our purposes, we're assuming it's all the same. There's something in the walls of the pot. You're cooking something else in it. What are the ramifications? There may be differences, but for our purposes, there's enough sophistication here. I will tell you a little secret. The text that we're using is straight Shulchan Aruch. I went through and deleted all the footnotes because there are tons of footnotes on this section, and I just felt it was sophisticated enough without any distractions. So I did you the favor and I got rid of all the footnotes. You can do them for homework. One word of introduction. One of the greatest gifts that we have in Jewish literature is the Shulchan Aruch. Until the Shulchan Aruch, even with the accomplishment of the Rambam trying to codify things, but basically until the Shulchan Aruch, you had to be an enormous scholar. You really had to know all the literature to be able to issue a ruling on a halachic topic. And the accomplishment of the Shulchan Aruch really is that a person can find the chapter that pertains to his question. It's not going to turn you into a posek or a Talmud Chacham overnight, but it gives you what should I read if I want to know about this topic. And the gift of the Shulchan Aruch is really to the credit of two great individuals. One of them, Rabbi Yosef Cairo, who was of Sephardi direction and is known to the Sephardim under the name Maron, the Master. And when we call him, we Ashkenazim, call Rabbi Yosef Cairo the Machaber, the author of the work by which we live, Shulchan Aruch, the Sephardim think we're being disrespectful. Because to them, he's Maron, the master. But however you express yourself, it's quite clear in both attitudes that this is a trend-setting sefer. The reason it's universally accepted is because although Rabbi Yosef Cairo was of Sephardi leanings and relies more on the Rambam, for example, than Rashi and the Bali Tosfos, who were the Ashkenazic scholars, the reason it's so well accepted is because the Ramah, who corresponded with Rabbi Yosef Cairo, by the way, the Ramah wrote editing notes to Rabbi Yosef Cairo's work. And because the Ramah, the Rav in Krakow, represented Ashkenazic Jewry, Rabbi Yosef Cairo's work plus the Ramah's editing notes made this one book the universal text for the Jewish people. If you're Sephardi, you read. If you're Ashkenazi, you read. And you know exactly where you stand based on this co-authorship of one work. Reb Tzadok HaKohen writes that that's to the credit of the Ramah. He could have easily, and he was planning on writing his own sefer for Ashkenazic Jewry. And when he saw Reb Yosef Kairo release his, he realized it would be far better serving to the Jewish people to write editing notes on Reb Yosef Kairo's work. And I believe you're going to see how that unfolds in tonight's session very clearly. Listen, even the outsiders are excited. Everybody has the case? We have a parav item. We're cooking it in a pot that has previously cooked either fleishik or milchik. And therefore, even though now it is spotlessly clean, we want to know, are you allowed to use the leftovers of the parav item cooked in a specific type of pot for the opposite type of meal? So in our case, our yummy macaroni that was cooked in a milchik pot, can I now use it as a pasta dish? The leftovers that never came in contact with cheese, can I use it as a pasta dish together with meatballs? Says the Shulchan Aruch, Simen Tzadi Hei. Remember, right now, we're talking parav leftovers according to the Sfardim. Because the opening statement is generally going to be, as it is here, from Rabbi Yosef Kairo. He states, Dogim shenisbashlu o shenitzlu bikedero shalbosa rechutza yofe. You have fish, it's a parav item. It's been cooked or roasted, fried in a pot that's meat designation, but it's been washed very well. She'ein shum shuman davuk bo. There is no meat residue left in this pot by the time we're having our discussion that the parav item was introduced. Says the Mechaber, Mutter la'achlam bekusach. You're allowed to eat this parav item cooked in a fleishik pot. You're allowed to eat it together with a milchik dip. Mushim dave nosin tam, bar nosin tam, deheteira. Because it is a derived taste of a derived taste, and it's all permitted. What does it mean, permitted? Had you cooked treif meat in the pot would become treif. And when you put something else into the pot, it's going to become treif. You can't say, well, it's weakened. But when you have meat and dairy, there's a phenomenal concept that each one is permitted in and of itself. Meat is perfectly permitted, just keep it on its own, right? Officials add meat and dairy, but never together, right? So the meat is fine on its own. The dairy was fine on its own. It's only when you brought them together that we had a problem. So you have the meat taste going into the pot, one level. Now the meat's been removed. That meat taste is coming out of the walls of the pot into the water, and the item is still parav. Now I want to know if I could use that parav item with the opposite type. The Mechaber holds, you're allowed to. One observation before we go on to the Ramah's dissenting opinion, which is the way we paskin. The entire presentation here is after the fact. You're never allowed to cook an item in a certain type of pot, fleishik or milchik, with intent to use it with the opposite type. We're only talking after the fact because there are leftovers. And that's the translation we're going to use throughout the session. We're talking about pariv, leftovers. You with me? Leftovers. Never initially. Yeah.
What if they're purposeful leftovers? Like you're making, enough, you're picking it, and you think, okay, not for me, but like for some sport.
That's the million-dollar question. Well, it's going to have ramifications for us as well, as Ashkenazim. What's classified as leftovers? It has to be legitimate leftovers. You can't double cook. You're cooking for the meal. There ends up being something happened, a person didn't show up, people didn't eat as much as you thought, but there's a normal way. I'll give you an example. It's not such a far-fetched thing, right? A lot of people, they open a box of macaroni and they cook the box. Now, they didn't do portion control. They didn't figure out, so how hungry are you tonight? And how hungry are you tonight? And we're going to put in just the right amount and we're going to leave, 43 macaronis left in the box, uncooked, because I didn't think they were needed. I think that many of us, the way we cook, you open the box, you put the box in, I'm never quite sure, sometimes it gets used down to the last thing, people are very unpredictable, sometimes they're just not in the mood of macaroni and cheese, and we'll be having it for the next 4 or 5 days, until you finish it. So, what's called leftovers, it has to be legitimate leftovers. Person who purposely dumps in 2 boxes of macaroni, knowing that they're going to only need 1, is not what we're talking about. Says the Mechaber further, if the pot was not properly washed, if you had residue that was more than nullification of 1 in 60, then you would not be able to eat it with a milchik dip because it would become fleishig. You'd have residue, and it would be forbidden. So, everybody agrees we're dealing with a very clean pot. But our question is, can I take that pariv item and use it with the opposite type? And we're in acknowledgement that we're talking about leftovers. We're not talking about purposely cooking in the wrong type. It's leftovers. Am I allowed to use it with the other type? Let's continue with another example, and then we're first going to encounter the approach of the Ramah, which is the way we paskin for Ashkenazim. Sif Beis. Beitza shenisbashla b'mayim b'kdera cholevis. Let's now take an egg boiled in a pot that is designated dairy. I made a good milchik oatmeal in it. I know it's a dairy pot. And now, after it's been cleaned, I put in an egg, nice lonely egg, and I boil it up. Is that a milchik egg? Mutu losei soso besocha tarnagolas afilu lechatchila. According to the Mechaber of Yosef Cairo, it's not milchik in the slightest. You can take that egg, peel it, and put it into your cholent.
Purposely.
Purposely. Afilu lechatchilo. Even purposely, according to the Mechaber. That's where we're going to argue. Avalim nisbashla b'kedera im basar. But if you boiled it in the pot, while there was meat in there, you have 1 cube of meat floating in the water and 1 lonely egg floating in the water. That egg becomes fleishik. Afilu beklipa, even if it has a shell, we know the shell is porous. Shell doesn't help you. Asur la'achla bekutach, then it would become definitively fleishik, and you would not be allowed to eat it with dairy. Right? Always paying attention, just the other type, because we switch back and forth from fleishik to milchik. Okay. Finally, pariv leftovers, according to the Ashkenazim, this is where we come in. But it's important to appreciate how far Rabbi Yosef Kairo went and how far we're going to go in arguing with that. Watch closely. Haggah. Note. Yesh machmirim b'tzliya u'bishol, when you've roasted or cooked something in a pot that has designation. Meaning, we're not talking about that you just put it on a plate that's fleishik or milchik. We're talking that you cooked it or you roasted it. You let it sit there in that type of pot. Les or no saint tam, bar no saint tam. We forbid no saint tam, bar no saint tam, not bar not. It's forbidden. V'haminig les or lechatchila. The minig is that initially we forbid it. Uvidyeved, but if it was already mixed in by mistake, mutter b'chol inyan, it's totally permitted. In other words, we acknowledge the position of Rabbi Yosef Kairo. I hear where you're coming from. It's true. Not bar not, it did not really become fleishik. It was cooked in a fleishik pot. It didn't become fleishik. Likewise, in a milchik pot, it didn't really become milchik. But, lechatchila, we consider it like it's fleishik. We consider it like it's milchik. How far do we consider it like it's fleishik or like it's milchik? To the point that we will not be allowed to eat it directly together. You wouldn't be able to take the egg that's milchik vessels and put it into the chicken. Because you're taking a dairy-like egg and putting it with fleishik. And likewise, the reverse, if you had an item that was sitting in a fleishik pot, you wouldn't be able to have it with this classic milchik dip. Says the Rama, if you botched up, you made a mistake, you already mixed it in, all eggs sitting in the fridge look the same, all macaroni sitting in the fridge looks the same, I didn't realize it was on the fleishik shelf where my wife intentionally put it. And I took it out from the fleishik shelf and used it with cheese. And she walks in just as I am making my mizonos. The Rama says, after the fact, you don't have to throw it out. After the fact means I already mixed it in. But if she walked in while it was still macaroni without the cheese, and I say, I'm a headstrong guy. I already planned to join it with the milchik. I could already taste the flavor of the macaroni with the cheese on my tongue. She tells me, that's not what you told me, the Rama says. The Rama says, only after the fact. And that means it was actually mixed. Once it's mixed, you can do it. But you're not allowed to do it otherwise. What would happen? A Sfardi is allowed to follow the ruling of Rabbi Yosef Kairo, which is lenient, which is that once it's a not bar not, you're allowed to go purposely and cook it, eat it, mix it with the other type. Let's say the Sfardi, unknowing that you were coming over, mixed it for themselves, because they're allowed to. Now you walk in and say, my house, I can't get in, I can't find the key, you don't want me to break a window, do you have anything I can eat? Well, I do.
Very good.
I do, but to the best of my recollection, you're Ashkenazi, aren't you? Well, I mixed fleishik kalim macaroni with cheese. It's mixed already. You want it? Very good. It's b'di'evet. What's the difference if it happened in my home by mistake, in an Ashkenazi home, and it happened by mistake, or it and it's permitted, or it happened in a Sephardi home purposely,
because
they're permitted to do that? I believe that's fine. But again, going back to the way we balance Minhagim and Piskei Halacha and everything, we do try to have reverence to the other person's minig, and I would not purposely, if I was Sephardi, mix it knowing that my guests were Ashkenazi. I wouldn't do that. But if I did it for myself, it's the same as b'di'evet by us. It's permitted. Let's move on. What happens if you have a non-ben yomo pat? What's a non-ben yomo pat? A pat that has not been used in 24 hours. So we always ask this question when there's a mess up. As much as we say things are designated milchik and designated fleishik, but sometimes someone tells me they mixed the corn with a fleishik teaspoon. And we will ask, what's fleishik about the teaspoon? I mean, what do we do with teaspoons that makes them fleishik? So sometimes people will say, well, I ran it through the fleishik dishwasher, and the fleishik from the cholent splattered all over, so now the spoon is fleishik. That's a good answer. But sometimes you wonder, like, okay, so what's fleishik about the item? When we're dealing with Eina ben yomo, we're not asking, was it ever fleishik? I know it was fleishik. There's no question in my mind it's fleishik. But it hasn't been used in the last 24 hours. What's its status if you cooked the par of item in such a pot? V'cheinim hoya haklish en esbashlu o nitzlu bo lefgam shelo hoya ben yomo. Our tradition is that once a taste in a pot is aged 24 hours, it's no longer a favorable taste. Noagim heter lechatchila, you're allowed to take the leftovers and purposely mix them im hamin hasheni. Now, it takes a little bit of concentration to appreciate the difference over here. But if you're dealing with a pot that has been used in 24 hours, the Rama is telling us you're not allowed to mix it with the other type, even though it's leftovers and even though the pot was clean. Only after the fact, if it was mixed by mistake, you'd be allowed to eat it. Over here we're saying that if the pot has not been used fleishik in the last 24 hours, it's a little bit more lenient. And therefore, the leftovers, we're still talking leftovers, we're still talking a clean pot. But over here we're saying that you'd be allowed to take the leftovers and purposely mix it with the other type. So if you cooked macaroni in a milchik pot that has not been used for milchik in the last 24 hours. Last time I used it, Rabbi, I think was a week ago. So that's an Eina ben yomo milchik pot. You're not allowed to put two boxes of macaroni in there intending to use it for your fleishik meal. But if you put in your one box, and now, sitting in the bottom of the fridge are leftovers from that meal, the leftover par of macaroni that was never mixed with milchik. That leftover par of macaroni, you're allowed to directly use with meatballs in order to use up the leftovers, because that original milchik pot that made it, milchik kalim, is not actively milchik. Is that wow?
Well, it means that you could just have enough pots to just sort of recycle pots.
No, you can't. No, you're never allowed to do this purposely.
No, I don't understand, but it means if you had enough pots in your house,
okay,
accidents would be less, like, you know.
Why don't you just have far more farm pots to, if you know, if you want to.
So that's correct. If you're doing this purposely, you would have to have a power of pot. And then you boil up as much as you want, and you use it as you need it, and you keep it powerful. Correct.
Now, let's say the leftover, let's say you have some noodle left over, you did it in a dairy pot, you have little noodle left over, you didn't keep them in the pot, you kept them in a container, in a plastic milk container.
Yeah.
And so then you're still allowed to do that. Like, you have little leftover, you have a little container, and your son come and tell you, Mommy, I see that meat sauce. Can I mix these two together? And we know that the original pot was rested for 24 hours, was not used for the last 24 hours.
You're allowed to do that.
It's still, even though I have a, you know, they were in
the
a dairy.
The original milchik pot was not
used
within 24 hours. You put it into a container, but didn't cook it in it.
Right.
You put it in a container.
The container was clean. Right.
That container was clean. That container was cold. That container is milchik of whatever type. It's milchik. If it's milchik, whatever, it's milchik. Fine. But it's not. It's not going
still
to
the same
make
ruling.
It still hasn't been milchik in 24 hours, and therefore the resulting leftovers would be allowed to be mixed. Okay? I don't know what to tell you. Should I tell you, you know, don't practice this on your own? I can guarantee people are going to make a mistake and misunderstand and whatever. Yeah, I don't know. But I think it's important that people understand why the term nat bar nat and why the term fleishikelem milchikelem is confusing. But it's all documented. Exactly what our minig is and what we do and what you're allowed to do. And on a matter of practice, you can simply say, you know, it's the rabbi's job to be up to date on this. It's only my job to be able to ask. And if I've got leftovers that I don't want to throw out, I can make a phone call and ask. But this is the critical information. Was the pot that's making it fleishik or milchik? Kalim, not fleishik or milchik. That we know for sure. The mechaber was ready to let you eat them together. But whatever is making it, milchik and fleishik, kalim, is it within 24 hours or is it not within 24 hours of its last use? And then we can give you an answer. Are you allowed to mix it in? Or is this isolated leftovers that may very well end up in the garbage because I don't know what to do with it? Okay. Are we ready for the curveball? No? Almost.
I thought that was it.
That was it. Okay. So we did the curveball already. Now we're going to do the slider. What happens if a spicy food is introduced to the equation? The rule of a truly spicy food, and the question is how spicy we have to go to make it spicy. The typical example is onions. Some people extend it to pickles. But the more traditional examples of spicy foods went as extreme as a very sharp radish, or perhaps those very sharp peppers that you can get to the farmer's market for cooking only. I have a friend who bit into one, and he was burning and burning and burning and burning, and they called the doctor, and they told him you can neutralize it by drinking milk. And he tried to neutralize it with milk, but it was burning like crazy. to the point that he remembered the incident for a few hours, and about 2 weeks later, when he was drinking from the same cup that he drank the milk from to try to neutralize it, he again experienced that same stinging sensation. And he realized why, because whatever you describe it as, but whatever that is, it was on the cup. We're talking about things that are sharp in varying degrees. The most common is an onion, when it's still sharp. Kolze, kisha ha-maychol eino davar chorf. All of what I've told you, leniencies, is if you're not dealing with a sharp item. Avel mahaya davar chorif, but if it was sharp, kigon shabishlo devarim charifim v'kli shal basar, you actually cooked, fried onions, something very sharp, maybe even more extreme. The question always by onions is that within a certain amount of time, they become sweet. They're not sharp anymore. So the question always would be, did it get hot in time that it was still sharp? But in any case, afilu eina ben yomo, if you did introduce a very sharp dish, particularly I think the Sfardi or Temani way of cooking could qualify on many, many dishes in their initial phase before they start mixing other things in and making it palatable. But in its initial phase, no, you didn't understand what I said. You thought it was funny.
I think everything's funny.
Okay. No, the rule of charif is that you can't eat it. You can't eat it. The way it is, I can't eat it. Not just a cultural thing. It's too sharp. Right? And then you dilute it with other things. I mean, people ask, is cucumber salad sharp? I mean, it might be sharp, but it's not charif. If it was charif, you wouldn't put it on the table and serve it. Right? But you could sometimes have something that's so sharp that the only way to eat it is by smearing a very thin layer on a big chunk of challah with a big cup of water next to you. So then that's charif. Right? Afilu eine ben yomo. If it's charif, even if it's not within 24 hours, o shedachu tavli b'mada shabasa, or if you chopped it in a blender, im achla b'chalav, oser afilu b'diyeved, it's going to forbid it ad ikas samach neged abasa abalu abahem, because the item becomes truly meat, and you'd need 60 against it. What's happening over here is that, and this is why everybody's always cautious, and they always ask shaylas. If it involved onions, you have to ask a shayla, because onions activate old taste and make it favorable. So you have a pot that hasn't been used in 24 hours. I haven't used it in a week. I'm so proud of myself. The mess up happened, but I haven't used it in a week. Okay? What power of item were you using it with now that you're asking about? Onions. I chopped up onions. I fried them in a milchuk pot. I then threw them into my cholent. What's the rule on the cholent? Well, let's work this through. You threw milchuk onions into your cholent.
Ouch.
Ouch, we have a problem. But what's milchik about the onions? Well, it was a milchik pot. But I haven't used the pot in 24 hours. That's correct. Except that a spicy item will activate a more than 24 hour type taste and make it favorable. Finally, what is charif? Mikom makom lo mikri machal davar charif mishum ma'at tavlin shabo. Just because you put in some spices doesn't make something charif. Rakim kula hu davar charif. It's got to be majority sharp. Rubo kukulo, majority counts as all. And the basic definition that we talk about is that it's difficult to eat straight. again, cucumber salad, just because you put in some vinegar and you put in some salt and you put in some onions, hopefully it's palatable. Mm. Otherwise, you go back to culinary school. But if it's something that's so strong that you can't have it, or it's very difficult, you have to really dilute it, so then that original product is considered harif, and it's going to activate whatever types of tastes we're dealing with. Mm. Okay. On the bottom of the page, we have vacation. Instead of struggling through, not bar not, this is taken from the OU bulletin. Daf HaKashrus, I think, is where I pulled this from. What does DE mean? Right? Dairy equipment. But the OU doesn't want to use it anymore. I think that at one point they might have, but they don't do it. So power of products made with heat on dairy equipment may be eaten after meat, but not with meat. So far, great synopsis. Some kashrus agencies use a DE symbol, but the OU has chosen not to use a DE designation because it is felt, fasten your seatbelts, because it may be confusing to the kosher consumer. I know a lot of kosher consumers who disagree. Also, to be a true DE product, the equipment must be properly cleaned of residue after dairy production. That's true. We saw that clearly. It's got to be totally clean to have these leniencies. And that level of cleanliness is sometimes difficult to maintain and guarantee. Well, they're the boss. If they don't feel that they could clean the equipment properly and it's not cost-effective, remember that what's driving the kosher market, with all due respect, is not the kosher consumer. What's driving the kosher market is a whole lot of non-Jews who are interested in buying kosher because they think it's better or more special or whatever. And it has to do with the companies that feel that if they get their extra 1% of market share, it's worth going kosher on the entire line. But they're not really driven on the kosher part, and therefore this DE might become like one of those areas that's just hard to convince people to go ahead, and the OU is not comfortable that they could deliver on it, and that really is to their credit, that if they don't feel that they could deliver with integrity, they're just not going to do it. Consumers may contact the OU consumer hotline, or, this is very important, the Webby Rebbe. That's their web question answer. To inquire if a product is DE, please note, it's possible for them to reformulate the DE and make it truly dairy. You will never know this, because the OUD kosher symbol is going to remain the same. We recommend you call our office every 3 months to reconfirm that the DE of your favorite dairy cookie is indeed still produced on dairy equipment without having gone actual dairy. Okay. We're going to do the second side, taking some shortcuts. Just going to basically cover the basic theme so that we can hit our target of completion within reasonable time. I always promise people who come to my classes to get them home by midnight. Only some people found that funny. Let's take a look at the top line. The other big exception to this fleishik, milchik, as long as it's clean, there's some leniencies to be had, rule, is not only if you cooked an item that was sharp, but also, very famously, if you cut an item that was sharp. We have a principle called duchga de sakina, the pressure of the knife going through a sharp item transfers taste. So if you cut an onion with a fleishik knife, the onion is assumed to be fleishik. If you cut an onion with a milchik knife, it's assumed to be milchik. This is even more serious than some of our other things that we encountered on the first page, in that even after the fact, if it was mixed in, it could make your food not kosher. You'll take a look at the second paragraph, and I bolded on the second line with an underline, the way it's brought in Shulchan Aruch, Tzorich Shishim, you're going to require 60 times. That means that even though it was mixed in, that means this is after the fact. I already mixed my onions in with the other dish. It's not going to help you to say, well, it's already mixed. I remember if it's already mixed. Doesn't help you.
This is like the Harif, isn't it? The Harif says...
This is all a Harif page.
Right, but I'm thinking of the Harif food, right? It said also...
Yes. It was also right. Shishim. You didn't have those leniencies by Harif.
Right.
Correct. And therefore, we are very cognizant of the way we cut a sharp item. Likewise, if you took a spicy food and put it into a blender, the blender blades are essentially knives. It's fancy knife, but that's basically what it is. It's a rotating knife. And you're having a knife cutting a sharp product, the product will acquire the type that the knife was. If the blender is fleishik, then it's going to become fleishik. Horseradish root that we grate for Seder night is a sharp product. If you're not convinced, you can come over and try it. It's a sharp product. If you cut it with a fleishik knife, it's considered fleishik. Not sure what you intended to do with it, but if you intended to be versatile and still be able to use it as a spice in a milchik dish, then cut it with a parav knife. One of the interesting shailas that comes up is regarding lemons. And this is because this doesn't just apply to fleishik and milchik knives, it applies to treif knives too. If a non-kosher knife cuts a spicy food, it makes the spicy food non-kosher. Hence the question, you go into a hotel lounge and you order Sprite, and they serve you Sprite with a freshly sliced lemon. Because we're classy. And you look at the lemon and you wonder, who cut the lemon? And the bartender says, wait, who cut the lemon? I cut the lemon. With which knife? What do you mean, with which knife? With my knife. Did you perchance cut your hot non-kosher pastrami sandwich with the same knife?
Get out of my bar.
None of your business. Seriously, where does that leave us? So there's a very interesting approach which is used, that if we don't know how the item was used, and it's clean, and they're cutting lots of the item, so then we assume bittul. And since he cuts lots of lemons at the same time, we assume that any one slice of lemon is bottled to the group, and you don't have to worry that your one slice is the one that's treif. And therefore, if you want to be machmir, you can pull out the lemon and just leave it on the napkin. But in terms of the intensity of fear that something from the lemon dripped into my soda, we really don't have to. And that's actually, it's based on a Shulchan Aruch. If you want, you could peruse it under the title Lemons.
Does this just pertain to lemons, this particular stuff?
Well, I'm giving you ideas. I'm not expecting you to pass in all your shilas on your own. I was thinking of going on sabbatical for a bit. But seriously, I just want people to know what's considered a shaila and why we're careful about certain things like spicy items. What's the question here? But no, it's not limited to lemons. It's any spicy food has the same rule. If they cut tons of it, the previous paragraph you could also look at has to do with ginger. So we assume that the ginger was uprooted with working tools, not with the same knife that he cuts his roast beef sandwich. But even if it was that he cut it with his roast beef knife, it's still going to be batel because he's not just doing your one ginger. He's doing thousands of such product at the same time. Okay, the final thing that I wanted to do tonight is a brief explanation of what we mean when we talk about something called a chazaka check. Chazaka check means that you might not have to check every single leaf of the batch of, let's say, romaine lettuce, for example, but rather you wash the product in a universal way, the entire case, the entire batch, with the same origin, same field, gets washed in exactly the same way. And then we check a designated amount of the product. And if that product comes clean, no bugs, if we know what we're checking for, and we find that the washing process worked, then we can assume that just like it worked on the amount of product that we checked after the washing, we can assume that it worked for the entire batch. The reason I mention this is because a lot of people misunderstand the chazaka check, and it sounds very lenient. You get a full case of romaine lettuce. If I can manage to check three heads and find no bugs, then I could just use the rest of the case. And that's moderately absurd. That's not what we're saying. We're saying that you cut every single head the way you're supposed to, you open up the leaves, you wash it all with a universal process, whatever that process is, soaking in soapy water, spraying with a sprayer, whatever it is, you use the same method on the entire batch. And then you take a certain number of samples of the batch and check to see if your washing method worked. And if it worked, then you assume it worked on everything.
What are you checking? You're checking the water or you're checking
the leaves? Beautiful. Old school of thought was to check the leaves. You take a certain number of heads, and you take a certain number of leaves, and you take a certain number of portions, and you're checking every leaf. The latest in kashrus, and with this we conclude tonight, is that you sandwich a thrip cloth in between two colanders. They do not have to be Betty Crocker colanders, but it helps. And you take the water that you've used for washing and you run the water through the colander, knowing that the thrip cloth is going to catch anything that you're going to need to examine. Like this, instead of putting every single leaf over the light box or however you're checking, if you're doing your agitation properly, and if you're doing your washing and you've used soap, and if you've done everything correctly, whatever your problem is, if there is a problem, it's going to be in the water. And all you need to do is check the water. And the idea is that you run it through here, and then you just have to check one thing to see if your sample is coming out clean. And that's the idea. Obviously, it means that you truly washed it properly. Otherwise, the stuff would still be on the leaves, and your thrift cloth doesn't help anyone. But if it's been washed properly, it'll be in the water. You run the water through the sieve. Your problem, if there is one, will show up in the sieve. Starkey's policy is that you can repeat the process up to 3 times. That means that if the first washing, and then you take sample, you're finding bugs, you're allowed to rewash the entire batch, right? You're not just rewashing the sample. That's horrendously artificial. Yes, the ones that I washed have no bugs. What about the rest? Chazaka check is really, it's supposed to make sense. It means everything was washed the same way. That's how, for example, the Hashgacha walks into Dole and verifies that they're not verifying, they didn't magnify every single one of the lettuce leaves that goes out to you. What they did was they took samples and they know that this washing process works. And they could run it through a thrip cloth. And then on this one thrip cloth, even if a mashgiach is a little overworked, for one thrip cloth, he pays very close attention. He goes through it very carefully. There's a little dirt, but if he finds a bug, he knows that the washing method is not yet producing clean product.
How do you know what the designated